UW-Madison Campus Voices mission is to capture, present, and preserve some of the strongest historical stories and memories of UW-Madison through the people who lived them. Campus Voices, a project of the UW-Madison Oral History Program, consists of presenting extant archival material in 21st century formats, such as a podcast, mini-movie, and iTunes album.
The following 12 oral histories are compiled from our collections in the university archives. In 1990, the Archives, in conjunction with WHA Radio, conducted interviews with former residents of Badger Village for use in a radio program profiling the community. Many of the clips included here come from this project, and some interviews were conducted and recorded entirely by the residents themselves. Most of the stories you will hear describe the Badger Village experience fondly. Some do not. Regardless, they provide us with a glimpse of the post-war years on the UW campus and give voice to the student experience of what Tom Brokaw called the greatest generation. I'm Kristen Schumacher, current junior in the undergraduate history department here at UW-Madison, and a member of the Campus Voices staff. I'll be leading the narration today. Our story begins in the closing years of World War II. Military actions overseas were coming to an end, and while the world had suffered devastating losses, the domestic economy had been revived by government investment in wartime industry. As young veterans began returning home, enrollment in universities across the nation began to rise, and in 1944, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Servicemen's Readjustment Act, also known as the GI Bill of Rights. University education, once a privilege reserved for the rich, had been defined under the Act as a right entitled to any eligible veteran who chose that path. The initial hope was to delay millions of young men's entrance into the workforce and avoid a flooding of the job market. Indirectly, the bill brought about drastic changes in the character of American universities. While the national narrative hardly ends here, this is where our local story begins. At a large public university like UW-Madison, the enrollment increases were already cause for concern by 1943, when then-university president Clarence Dykstra called for the creation of a post-war planning commission to address the issue. By 1947, 23,000 students attended the University of Wisconsin at Madison. 11,000 of them were veterans. This massive influx demanded increasingly creative solutions in order to meet the new students' needs. Here's Art Hovey.
The biggest concern of the university following World War II was to find the means to accommodate all of the veterans who were returning to the campus and who were having access to the university through the GI Bill. So the enrollment, which had been severely curtailed by the fact of the men and later women going off to war, was suddenly exploding. And there were two concerns then. Where are we going to find the instructional space for these people? And most of them being older, many of them were married students. And so we had to find housing accommodations for them. And this included almost every available space we could think of in the community. And we went so far as to go north to Baraboo, where we took advantage of the facilities that had been available to the workers at the ammunition plant up there and created a little community of our own called Badger Village.
While other temporary housing facilities, such as the trailer homes at Truax, were established for single veterans, Badger Village was purchased specifically to meet the needs of the new married student population. Before the war, 500 married male students had been enrolled at UW. By 1948, there were almost 4,000. Amidst a general housing shortage in the city, even small apartments were difficult to find, let alone homes suitable for young families, as Phyllis Young here describes.
Then we had a choice of going into an attic somewhere in Madison with two little kids, a fire trap, a house, or to Badger Village. There was no choice. We went to Badger Village in a hurry. And we're very glad to get there.
The project itself was born out of collaboration between the university and the federal government, allowing for the redesignation of wartime facilities for academic use, as Theodore Zillman here describes.
Badger Village was the housing complex put together during World War II to take care of the munitions workers that were then employed across the road in the Badger Ordnance Works. And there, I think the chief thing they did was to make powder for the war effort. Now, when the war was suddenly at an end, understandably the need for more and more powder was reduced drastically. And so Uncle Sam found itself with these Badger Village lean-tos and, I shouldn't say lean-tos, it was not the best of housing, as you can imagine.
On December 7th, 1945, the first student veteran moved into the former industrial complex. However, it wasn't until 1946 that a portion of the village was officially signed over to UW. Badger Village was initially conceived as an off-campus school to provide first-year classes such as English, mathematics, languages, and economics, along with on-site housing. However, due to great demand, it soon became a commuter village for veteran students of all ages. At the outset, no buses were provided to shuttle the students back and forth, and the first community transportation was a defunct school bus purchased by the residents themselves in 1946. Life at Badger was overall quite Spartan. The cost of an apartment was between $17.50 and $26.50, and the buses ran at a cost of 25 cents. On a GI salary of $80 a month, the cost of living was affordable, but it certainly didn't buy much. Here, Phyllis Young shares her first impressions of housing at Badger Village.
I think I would describe it as a sort of strange domesticated army base. I was thinking about this, and what did it look like to me? That's about as near as I can come. And then as you get closer, and as you get inside, they all seemed like, a house of cards, say. A very fragile, kind of impermanent feeling about these little quarters that we were in. It was roomy enough, but it was very, very fragile, I thought. Not slated long for this world. I did not feel, isolated. I think that was a question that came along. Did you feel isolated? No, not at all. In fact, I felt almost too surrounded. It was a very crowded feeling to me and very busy, a very busy atmosphere. Mostly women in the daytime. The men all climbed into the old rackety buses and off they went. But we were comfortably housed and very, very good from that point of view.
Here's Doris Moore, another Badger Village wife, describing the accommodations in daily life.
We were just happy to be by ourselves, and it was very rudimentary. It was just two rooms. It was in a converted barracks. It had been a barracks for people that worked in the ordnance plant, I believe, Badger. Ordnance plant, right? Anyway, we thought it was fun. It was going to be fun, and they did a nice job on converting those. They were two rooms. One room was part kitchen, part dining room, and part living room. And everything was new, like they had a new hide-a-bed in there, a new kitchen table and chairs, and a little apartment-sized stove, and not a refrigerator. It was an icebox. Mm-hmm. But we didn't have to empty a pan because they drilled a hole in the floor and the water just dripped right down onto the ground.
Okay.
And then there was a bedroom. And they provided bunk beds and wardrobe, and they didn't have closets, so they provided wardrobes. But we brought our own double bed from home, so we had that, and we didn't use the bunk beds. And then the bathroom facilities were down the hall, and the ladies had their bathrooms and showers, and the men had theirs. And so it was a community facility. And then there was also a laundry room. And I thought that was pretty great because we had all brand new washing machines, and they were not automatic washing machines. They were washing machines with wringers. And we could hang our clothes, and no dryers, of course. And so we, in nice weather, we could hang our clothes outside because they would string lines between the barracks. Mm-hmm. And in bad weather, they had a separate room where you could hang your laundry inside.
Here, Marjorie Johnson describes some of the daily difficulties brought on by these accommodations.
Another source of entertainment, I guess it was, but also ingenuity was required, was cooking, because it transformed. There was one transformer in Badger that was always defective. It was always going off. And there would be a flicker of a light, and we'd say, uh-oh, there it goes. And sure enough, all the electricity would go off. Well, at night, when we were supposed to have a meal, the only thing to be done was to open a can of Franco-American spaghetti or baked beans or something that was on the shelf, put it on the coal stove in a pot. The coal stove came in very handy. And then we would light some candles, and when the food in the on the coal stove was warm, we'd sit wherever we could and eat, have a candlelight meal, so to speak.
The homes themselves were poorly insulated, and the harsh Wisconsin climate caused endless troubles for many residents. Here, Marjorie Johnson describes some of the hazards brought upon the residents by Mother Nature.
We had one severe winter in 47 and 48. There was a big storm in early December. It partially melted and refroze in mid-December, and never really melted until March or April. So always the walking was treacherous. Even though they tried to use salt and sand, the driving was very bad, and the walking was almost impossible. Now, the highways, of course, were okay because they were taken care of, but the village itself in that year was a place of torture, I guess. In the same measure that the winters were cold, the summers were very hot because there was no circulation of air. And the bedroom had little tiny windows. We had to have a fan blowing directly on us all the time for any air at all.
The post-war years are known by another name, the baby boom. At Badger, the boom was practically an explosion. Single families that came to live in the village, almost without exception, left with a few more members in tow. While starting a new family in the aptly nicknamed Rabbit Village brought many residents great joy, it was very difficult. Here, Joanne Lampman recalls the stresses of young family life at Badger.
And anyway, we lived out there at Badger Village. Have you ever heard of anybody living out at Badger Village? Now that was rough living. Kids these days that live there at Eagle Heights don't know what it's about. I mean, we had a coal stove, for instance,
really?
In the middle of our living room, and my first son burned his arm learning to walk, sort of out there, and it was. And then the guys had to take a bus in every day, 30 miles.
So life in Badger Village was sounds as though it might have been a little depressing.
It was depressing, and it was rough, and we had no money to speak of. Well, I shouldn't say that. Because he still had Navy money. Maybe we were richer then than we were for the next 10 years. I don't know. Well, we always managed to get along, but it was such a grim little place that I guess, and we didn't attempt to do a lot of fixing up and stuff. We had, I was terribly busy with being pregnant with a second and having a boy a year old.
Sure.
I mean, we had two just 13 months apart.
Oh, my.
So I was too busy to think about anything else.
Yeah.
While some residents did find Badger quite grim, as the community became more established, the university and students worked together to make life easier. By 1947, a UW-supported fleet of 35 buses was provided to transport residents of Badger and Truax to the campus. Here, Robert Korak, the manager of the Truax bus system, explains some of the difficulties encountered in maintaining this patchwork fleet.
We had trouble getting enough buses. We had only two what I call city-type buses built by Ford. There were Ford Transit buses. And the rest was a collection of dilapidated school buses and ex-Army buses that we were lucky to keep going. I remember one particular bus bouncing along down East Washington Avenue one night, bounced right off of its chassis. The body seemed to go in one direction, the chassis in another. However, we were pretty resourceful, and even though the bus looked like it fell apart, we had it back together and running again.
Here, Donald Anderson tells another story regarding the difficulties in transportation.
One evening, we were coming back from university, and the bus, it was 14 below zero, and the bus stopped in Middleton and refused to run. So then we all got out and hitchhiked back up to Baraboo. And I thought some more about how nice it would be to be back in Washington. I hadn't had that hard a time, even in the Army.
Despite these trying circumstances, most residents recall the struggles and the ingenuity they inspired with a certain fondness, as Doris Moore explained.
Everybody was in the same boat.
Yeah, that's what I think probably what made it enjoyable. Nobody had any money, and you counted your pennies at the end of the month. And there was a general store right on the grounds, so you could go to that. I think we call it the commissary. I don't know if that was the right term. And then in the summer, they provided grounds and land for us to have a garden. So we had a garden.
They plowed it?
Yeah.
For us?
And it was a good size garden.
We had a garden that was about 40 feet by 60.
Mm-hmm. So we thought it was pretty much fun. I don't know if I'd want to, certainly wouldn't want to do it again right now, but at the time we thought it was not too bad.
By its very nature, Badger was a unique community comprised of families with similar situations, experiences, and backgrounds. The pervasive feeling of community developed out of these common bonds, but also by democratic design. At its inception, Badger Village was intended to be much more than simple university housing. It was meant to be a microcosm of American government and society. Here's Peggy Baim describing her experiences when she first came to this new community.
I guess Badger Village was just a U-turn in my life. I was born and raised in Minneapolis, and it was city and apartment dwelling, but a lot of diversity. But let me tell you, when I got to Badger Village, I had a whole new meaning of that word. I was... The impact of people who normally wouldn't have gone to university at all was so great, because the people who were grad students were those that would have gone to university from their hometowns, but the rest of the people were people who never would have even dreamed of it. And that diversity was absolutely fantastic. It just was an impact of honesty, tension. We shared only that we were women and that most of us had children, and that we were poor.
In the community handbook, residents were told that this was their chance to prove that democracy, the principle they had fought for, could be made a reality at home. Communal spirit and cooperation were written into the foundation of Badger Village and often predominated in social relations. Here, William Sherrick recalls one such instance of this.
You remember, you make good friends, you all band together in time of need. I had a set of ratchet wrenches that I loaned all over the place so people could adjust their stoves and heating units. And one time I entered a contest. It was a Crusade for Freedom, a propaganda contest. So I came up with... Being in sociology and social psychology, I came up with some pretty good suggestions, and I won one of the three national prizes, which meant a trip to New York. By and large, I had nothing but school clothing, and I didn't have a good suit. I didn't have clothes I'd be proud to wear going to New York theater. And word got around, though. And one of the fellows who had a nice brand new pair of shoes my size let me have them. Another fellow let me have a suit. Another fellow let me have a top coat. So when I went to New York, I looked the part of a winner.
The village included an operating community center, post office, community council, police force, and an elected president. Alongside these civic operations, Badger also contained a shopping center, barber shop, drugstore, and primary school. The Badger Bulletin, a newspaper that reported on village matters and was produced and distributed at the site, was also available to residents. Given the fact that many of the students were also young parents, the village school was an especially valued resource. Here's Phyllis Young.
Well, when we got to Badger Village, we had one that was in first grade. She was a six-year-old. And we had a little boy who, as I said, was 8 months old by the time we arrived in Badger Village. The little girl, I think, had a very happy time. Well, I think a baby 1 year old will accept, or anywhere around one, will accept life as he finds it. And the little girl had one of the best teachers, I think, that any of my children have ever had. Her name was Esther Bubbly. I've remembered it all of these years, and I rarely do that. The schools, again, were of rather temporary looking, but they had a very light, airy, lively feeling. And it was a pleasant place for children.
Of course, diversions and entertainment were also important elements of the student experience. Here, former resident August Lemberger explains the opportunities for social engagement available in Badger Village.
The another aspect of the lifestyle at Badger, the recreational, the basketball court served as a dance hall, and there were occasional dances and parties, village-wide parties that were held there. And on Sundays, that facility was used for church services. We're Catholic, and the assistant from the parish in Sauk City used to come out and say Mass in the gym, and I think that there were Protestant services in the gym. So in a sense, it was a real community. All aspects of the lifestyle, all aspects of what you'd want in life really were provided right there at Badger Village. It was truly a village. We had the grocery store, we had the barbershop in the all-purpose building. There was a bar area. We could buy beer. There was no hard liquor, but you could buy beer. You could sit around and chat with your neighbors. Or you could, the most popular beer, because it was the cheapest beer, was Effinger. There was a little brewery in Baraboo, Effinger Brewery, and that was the most popular beer that was consumed at Badger. As I say, I'm sure it was not because of the taste, but because of the price.
As August Lemberger mentioned, dances were often held at the community center, allowing residents to relax, socialize, and enjoy the popular big band music of the day. Here, Larry Halley, manager of Badger from 1946 to 1951, describes the scene.
I think I mentioned a few minutes ago that about the social life at Badger. Now, there were a number of dances held because, particularly in the winter, they were popular, and they were of the cabaret type. The veterans were old enough to drink, and so they had they liked to have a cabaret affair with tables and beverages available. And I believe that one of the popular orchestras at that time was Don Vagley's orchestra in Madison, and they would come out and play for some of these dances.
Among the many events, speakers, films, and productions at Badger was a completely student-run variety show. Here's Peggy Baim, a ballet teacher and lifelong dancer, describing a particularly humorous sketch devised by the residents.
So we had a wonderful variety show, and I was a dancer. I'd studied ballet all my life, so I gave exercise classes out there. But one of the things we decided to do was the Swan Lake with all men. So all the men showed up expecting to really lampoon and jiggle around, and something I said, it's much funnier if you are serious. So suddenly they began to really train like ballet people, and I gave them a real workout, you know, and I gave them the real Swan Lake, and my husband was the male dancer, and then one of the smaller men was the queen, you know, the Swan Queen, and we tied a rope on him, so when my husband would lift him up, the rope carried him way off stage, way out of his hands and far, far away. But we did the Swan Lake incredibly seriously. They got it right away, and it just was a fantastic version of Swan Lake with these men in their tutus. And so that variety show was fun, and there were lots of humorous skits and things.
Here's August Lemberger describing a different variety of social event.
Sorry. Among the things that we did do for recreation that should probably be mentioned is that we did have a lot of athletic events. We had softball leagues in the spring and summertime. We had basketball leagues in the wintertime. We played a lot of touch football out there. In fact, one of the things that we did in Building 3 at Thanksgiving time, we would get together and the north end of the building, the 12 units on the north end, the 12 guys would play the 12 guys from the units on the south end of the building in what we call the toilet bowl game. It was a touch football game, and we would do that in the morning. And women, this may sound chauvinistic, but at the time we all had a good time doing it. But they would get together and cook turkeys and make a huge Thanksgiving dinner. They did that cooperatively while the guys were off playing some football in the morning. And then we would have like 2 o'clock in the afternoon after the game, got cleaned up a little bit. Then we just have a building Thanksgiving dinner. And it was a great way to spend a holiday. That's among the fond memories of the time, too.
Of course, these two stories are a wonderful glimpse into the gender culture of the post-war years. It was a time of strict rules and expectations for men and women, and while the residents generally lived within these social boundaries, many crossed them and sometimes, as Baim describes, poked fun at them. However, in part due to the social expectations of the time, women and men experienced Badger Village very differently. While men recalled the academic woes, the women spent most of their daily lives in the village, caring for children and managing the household. The Badger Village wives were typically highly educated, often holding college degrees themselves. They were young mothers who rarely found opportunities to leave the village, and many were civically involved. Speakers, support groups, women's organizations, and social activities that included discussions of contemporary issues sprang up as vital parts of life at Badger, and wives played an active role. Here, Peggy Baim describes her experience in leading the Badger branch of what was called the Great Books Club.
So we went into Madison, got this training for several weeks, and read the material and came back, et cetera, et cetera. Came back and sat at a long table and put out a call, anybody wanting to talk great books, come. And we began talking Greek culture and all this, and the women began pounding fists, looking across the table. They'll say, well, you know, people who could really do this would be blah, blah, you know. And the other one says, you haven't been in my shoes. You haven't been spit on. And suddenly this debutante type, you know, it was just shook up. They would turn pale. They would confront each other. But they all stuck it out and listened. And it was mind-boggling to both sides of these women from both sides of the tracks in an old-fashioned way of saying it. It was just dramatic to see them, you know, confront each other. You haven't been poor. You haven't been kicked off the street. Your husband wasn't, you know, and your uncle wasn't lynched, you know, and, it's just shaking people. It was just so exciting to see them, but we stuck to the thing and say, do you think these kinds of issues, so we brought it back to the great books, always, to the original concept of the Socratic method of pulling out by questioning, what would you have done if you'd have been, you know, was that what you would have done? Why not? You know, so we just pulled them all out of each other. So we had people from every part of the United States, every economic pattern, every color, creed, social something. It was just the most exciting thing. So you'd go out of there literally shaking like you had been really through that part of a war. And in a sense, it was fighting out the real battles on the home front.
Residents were also visited by campaigning politicians such as the Socialist Party leader Norman Thomas, George Nelson, and, of course, Joe McCarthy. Two of the women in our interviews recalled Senator McCarthy's visit, though the accounts differed greatly. Phyllis Young recalled seeing McCarthy and viewing his talk quite favorably, enough so that she voted for him, which she later regretted. Peggy Baim, well, this is how Peggy recalled it.
And McCarthy came out, and he was talking along, and then the veterans would be hollering this election or something, something. Finally, he hollered out to him. He says, isn't there a Republican in the place? he just got shook up about that one.
For the women, the radio played an important role in maintaining political and academic involvement. Here, Marjorie Johnson explains the importance of the public radio station WHA.
I remember listening to the whatever classes were offered with enormous interest on WHA, because we needed more intellectual stimulation. Women did in those circumstances. Although we subscribed to a lot of magazines, I didn't have a lot of time to read unless the baby was sleeping, but I could listen to the radio while I was doing my household tasks, and so it was a very important element every day to me.
Here's Peggy Baim with some interesting insight on how WHA helped maintain equality in her marriage.
The other was WHA, and I tuned it in. I'm a news junkie anyway, and I was just starving for education, just starving for it. So I turned it on, and beautifully enough, the Integrated Liberal Studies lecture series was on. So I took voluminous notes. I had colored notebooks, one for each type of lecture, and just took all these notes. And my husband was taking the same courses. So when he would come home, I'd say, well, I heard Fred Harrington today. Well, I thought he said blah, blah, you know, so we just had really exciting, both growing. So that was really, WHA was just, you know, manna from heaven for me. And it was also kept our sense of equality as we matured, because it wasn't him having an education and my staying home, you know, learning how to make bread or knit or something.
We'll shift our focus now to the men, who also found themselves in a unique situation, this time within the academic environment. The courses and programs available at the university had been designed to provide an enriching experience for young students from well-to-do families. But, as we've discussed before, the GI Bill had brought about a demographic shift in the student population. The veterans, who came from less privileged backgrounds, were accustomed to military discipline and sought practical, career-oriented training. They felt that the pace and material of courses simply did not suit them. Here's Larry Halley.
Well, the veterans who had to postpone their education anywheres from 3 to 5 years were anxious to get their education, and they didn't want anything to interrupt that. And they were very serious. The university installed a 12-week summer semester, so they could go right through and not lose any time. They could take a full semester's work in the summer. And a lot of students did that. A number of the veterans who might not have been able to go to the university before World War II because of the Depression were now able to go to school, and they had worked and had working experience and were serious, and they put forth considerable effort. This was not a rah-rah campus at that time.
The new brand of veteran student shifted enrollment trends heavily toward the schools of business and engineering, and forever changed the curriculum and pace of the School of Journalism at UW. More generally, as one interviewee suggested, the veterans brought about a challenge to the concept of in loco parentis. Interestingly, this battle against university control of student life is often attributed to the social movements of the 1960s. In Badger itself, the student attitude was very serious, and the veterans were dedicated to their studies. Here, August Lemberger describes the atmosphere during the evenings as the men returned home to study.
As I recall, we studied in our own apartments at the kitchen table. Again, though, these were all veterans, or largely veterans in a married population, very serious about their education. So there wasn't a lot of hijinks going on in the hallways in the evening, at least not until 10 o'clock or so. And, of course, with the bus schedule, getting up when we did by 10:30, we were pretty well wrapped up anyhow. But you would study, you know, from dinner through studying. People didn't play their radios loud and disturb you. That I recall, I don't recall having a problem like that. And by and large, cooperative in seeing to it that the building was reasonably quiet at night. So probably the bigger deterrent to studying was the fact that the bus ride kind of wore you down. And, you know, you get home after that bus ride and unwind a little bit, and you'd really be kind of tired. I think your fatigue was more of a handicap to studying than the atmosphere in the building.
The studious atmosphere, just like the social life at Badger, was crafted and maintained almost entirely by the residents themselves rather than through top-down university enforcement. In fact, as the residents began to make their mark, this rugged temporary village in its final years became quite a desirable place to live, as Larry Halley described.
What the university intended when they opened Badger that it would remain open perhaps 3 or 4 years until the peak of the enrollment had passed and building in Madison caught up. However, building in Madison didn't catch up that fast, and the enrollment didn't slow down that quickly. Furthermore, living at Badger was very inexpensive. Many of the veterans paid only $18 a month rent, and the maximum was about $26.50. And you couldn't touch that in Madison. And while admittedly there were some hardships in living there, once you got used to it, it was pretty reasonable. And again, as the social activities and recreational activities increased, it became a reasonably attractive place to live. You could raise a garden across the other side of the highway where the ordnance plan allowed us to plant gardens. And so it was a pretty reasonable thing. And students decided we didn't want to move until we finish our careers, our academic work. And, of course, the manager of the bus operation started in as a freshman and finished with a law degree and a bachelor's in economics. And he lived the entire time there. And there were a number of other students whose graduate work took longer. And so they all stayed. So students were still living there in 1951 when the Korean War required that the ordnance plant be opened to produce powder. And at that point, the federal government decided they wanted to take back the housing. So we had to terminate our lease in 1951 with the agreement that students could remain who were there until they moved out or finished their careers, whichever happened last.
When the Ordnance Works reopened as an arsenal for democracy, official university affiliation with Badger ceased in 1952. The veteran population would continue to make sweeping changes in academia for some years, many of which remain as integral parts to the University of Wisconsin experience. Perhaps the single most reiterated sentiment amongst the interviewees can be summed up as this: we had nothing, but we felt lucky. To close our story, here's Doris Moore with her final reflections on life at Badger Village.
I don't know if I'd want to do it over again now, but it certainly was a very positive experience. We enjoyed it. I did. I thought it was a really nice experience. I liked all the people there. I felt we were pretty lucky, actually, considering the times, that we were pretty lucky to be able to have a place all to ourselves. The rent was certainly great. It was probably about $23 a month or something like that, and it was a good experience. I just kind of feel sorry for young people today that don't have to go through an experience like that. I know most young people today want to have their house all paid for, or at least have a house and have a car and have everything that goes with it. And we didn't have any of those things, and still we were very happy, and it was great.
If you would like to find out more about our Campus Voices collection and hear more stories like this from the university archives, please visit our website at archives.library.wisc.edu/oral-history/campusvoices. I would also like to thank the Brittingham Fund, whose support has made the production of this podcast, as well as the entire Campus Voices project, possible. Their generosity allows us to share these fascinating histories with the campus community and to preserve the voices of our past. Thank you.